I went looking for a story, and my friend Lynn brought me an adventure.
It's okay, we're Americans. We're here to help you.
My name is Bob Wilton. I'm a journalist. I've been investigating a story about a classified government program. I'd heard that the U.S. government was training psychic soldiers, and that Lynn Cassidy was the best of the best.
I've been reactivated. I'm on a mission.
I could come. Lynn's story was unbelievable, crazy, and completely true.
You must create warrior monks who can pass through walls and see into the future. Holy.
Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and here it is. Showtime again. And we have an interesting show tonight, and we urge you to stay tuned. Remember, we did a remote viewing special a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to get this fellow on that we're going to introduce in a minute, but he was on vacation. So we decided we'd ask him to come back the following Monday, and guess what? He was having a birthday party. But we finally have him, and it's Paul H. Smith, and we'll talk to him in a moment. I got a card, a very nice one this week, from an international cryptology museum person. I didn't know they had an international cryptology, but there is a museum called that. It's 11 Avon Street, and that's located in Portland, Maine. They had a painting on the card, and it's by Thomas E. Finley. And it's a painting of a sea serpent. And the sea serpent supposedly alive and is located at Gadboro Bay, I think is the way you pronounce it, up in British Columbia. And we have not done a show in a long time on cryptozoology. In fact, I think maybe the next time we do a special, maybe we'll do something on cryptozoology and wrapping a little Bigfoot and a few things like that. If you think it's a good idea, simply email me and tell me about it at jerry@jerrypippin.com. And since I mentioned my regular email, feel free to do that. It's Post Office Box 33, 333, Muskogee, Oklahoma, 74402. We have that address right there on our contact slip on our website, at jerrypippin.com. So feel free to correspond with us by email, phone, regular mail, you name it, we'll try it. Anyway, Paul Smith, I want to first of all say happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
And welcome to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I think this is the first time for us, is it not?
Yes, it is. We've talked about it, maybe doing it before, but the remote viewing thing came up, and I thought we've got to get Paul Smith on because he's quite an expert. And before we even really get into the show, let's talk a little bit about what you do down there in Austin, Texas. That seems to me you've been down there for a long time.
Yeah, I moved here less than a year after I retired from the Army. Came down to Austin and brought my remote viewing training company with me, but my main purpose was to work on a PhD here at the University of Texas.
And you evidently doing it for a long time now. How long have you been down there?
That would have been, let's see, the summer of 97.
I mean, you already had a birthday, so I don't mind dating you.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
I don't mean dating you as in kissing. I mean dating you as telling how old you are.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jerry. You're just not my type. I hope you're not offended. But yeah, I guess we just passed our 15-year anniversary here in Austin. Yeah. So it's been a great place.
And it's a pretty intellectual place. A lot of people know that already. But all kinds of things happen from Austin. Tell us a little bit about your business here and what you do.
Well, I wear a lot of different hats. But as far as how I make my living, of course, there's always military retirement. That's nice. That keeps me from going broke. But I teach people remote viewing, controlled remote viewing specifically, which I learned, of course, while I was in the military remote viewing program. That's been a very interesting career. In fact, while I was working my PhD in philosophy, when my professors found out what I was doing to put myself through school, it pretty much freaked them out, as you could imagine.
What did your professor think of remote viewing? I guess he was skeptical at first.
Well, some of them were very skeptical. Some of them started off skeptical, but I wouldn't say I converted them, but they began to take it seriously, at least consider it as a legitimate possibility. And others actually got a bit enthusiastic about it. So it was an interesting experience, not just for me, but for them as well. It was a lot of fun, actually. I always liked that reveal moment when you tell somebody who you know is going to be startled, you know, what it is you do for a living. They go, "What? I didn't think that stuff worked." And then I have the opportunity to show them, well, yes, in fact, it can work, and it has worked, and the U.S. government used it for 23 years, and successfully in most cases, or in many cases.
You brought up the U.S. government using it. Do you think they still do?
Well,
or can you say?
That question always comes up. In fact, Lynn Buchanan, who you had on not too long ago, he has this fun thing he says. He says, well, if they're doing it and I knew about it, I couldn't tell you. And if they were doing it and I didn't know about it, I couldn't tell you. So I'll just tell you I can't tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, but we talk show hosts don't like those answers.
Yeah. I'll tell you, my answer is usually, I think there's a 95% chance, you know, that's of course, you know, a rough percent, but 95% chance that they are not doing it. Based on...
Why do you think they stopped?
Well, I know why they stopped. It's because the organization, the remote viewing organization, got handed over to the CIA, and the CIA didn't want to do it. In fact, the director of the CIA at the time was a huge skeptic. In fact, he was famous for tossing people out of his office if they ever brought up the word remote viewing. And there was some politics going on, and decided it was better to move it out of the military and into the CIA. And that was essentially its death sentence, because they didn't want to have anything to do with it. They very cleverly kept the personnel slots open, because then they farmed them out to all their different agencies where they needed more people to do other things. but they got rid of the program, and it's very clear that they terminated it. Now, sometimes people say, well, they could be doing it and we wouldn't know about it, which is true. I mean, it's possible that they have a really highly secret program going on somewhere deep down, buried at Langley or someplace. But given the kind, first of all, given the history of remote viewing in the government, it was always something that there was fights over. You had the supporters of it trying to keep it alive, and you had the detractors and the skeptics trying to do away with it. And in the end, the detractors won, essentially. And I don't think that the nature of government has changed since then. That if you think about it, the kind of people who end up being successful in a government agency tend to be organizational thinkers. So they're generally linear thinkers. There's a place for everything, a thing for every place. They really want closure. They don't like these open-ended things. They don't like uncertainty. And that's just exactly the opposite kind of personality that can deal well with remote viewing. And so, since you have a preponderance of those kind of folks in bureaucratic agencies, it seems kind of psychologically no surprise to me that it had those struggles, and that that they had that they had trouble with that. So,
yeah, we opened a show with a little sound clip from The Man Who Steered Goats, and what did you think of that movie, or did you see it?
Oh, I saw it. I thought it was really funny. But also, I kind of appreciated the fact that it didn't pretend to be an accurate account. The closest thing came, it said at the beginning, more of this is, there's more truth here than you would think, or something like that. I don't remember, indicating that it wasn't all true, which it wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
but it was amusing. Now, the problem I had was with the actual book that it was taken from. The movie, of course, was even more far-fetched than the book was, but the book itself pretended to be true, and in fact, some of the stories it told were true, but they were cherry-picked. So they took the sensational stories out of context and failed to tell you the other side of the story, and so it formed in people's mind an entirely different opinion about how the program was, what it did, the kinds of things it was involved in that was actually true. So it's the standard story of taking a little bit of truth and making a complete deception out of it.
Yeah, let's talk a minute about, if you don't mind, about how you got exposed to remote viewing in the military. Look at your bio here. It's a pretty interesting story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
tell the audience a little bit about it.
Yeah,
you weren't aware of anything like this, right?
I was completely oblivious. I had no idea there was any psychic programs going on. In fact, I was a kind of a mild skeptic. I'd gotten involved in a science fair project in junior high where, you know, the Zener cards with the wavy lines and the star and the square and all that stuff, you know, we tried to telepathically send those patterns to each other, and it was a total failure. So I had become somewhat dubious that ESP even worked. And so when I moved to Fort Meade, I had been assigned there to work in a Middle East analyst position. I went along with what my education had been up to that point, thinking this was a normal intelligence place. You know? So I moved in, however, next door to Skip Atwater, who was the operations and training officer for the unit, and across the street from Tom McNair, who was one of the viewers. And, I did not know what they did, except that they both always wore civilian clothes, and Tom had a beard. And we're talking military officers living on an Army installation. What's with that, right? So I was instantly intrigued, but I had no idea what they were doing, and they had no intention of telling me what they were doing either, right? But they were looking for new recruits for a training program that they had just contracted with the folks who developed remote viewing in the first place. And so they kind of were assessing me at a distance, and I didn't even know it. One day Tom McNair asked me, "Well, I know you're very curious about what we're doing. We'd like to tell you, but we're thinking maybe of recruiting you, but we can't tell you what it is until you finish these tests." And he gave me a bunch of psychology and personality profile tests, those kind of things, kind of standard stuff. And so I did the test, and I gave them back to him. And a little bit later, he said, "Well, you scored about where we need somebody to score, so come on over, we'll read you on. And if you want to volunteer, you can. And if not, we'll just make you sign a non-disclosure statement, and you'll have to be silent about it for the rest of your life," essentially, right? So I said, okay. So I go over there and walk into this old beat-up building, and the World War II, condemned buildings from World War II era, right? But they're still being used. So I go in the back, and Tom sits me down, and he says, "I signed this statement, non-disclosure statement." He says, "What we do here is we collect intelligence against foreign threats using a parapsychology discipline called remote viewing. Essentially, we want to ask you to volunteer to become a psychic spy." And I'm going, "What?" But it was interesting because it took about 10 seconds. I had this thought process. I used to be interested in ESP, but I thought there was nothing to it. This guy just told me that the U.S. government is using ESP to collect intelligence. That must mean there is something to it. There's no way you can keep me out of this program. I'm going to say yes right now.
Right.
Yeah, so it was...
I agree with you. That would pique my interest for damn sure.
It was fascinating.
So you volunteered. And did you guys... I'm curious how it worked in the military. I'm a veteran. I didn't do that, however, but, they seem to have regimentation in the military. They make you go to work early in the morning and stay in the evening, or you had to pick your hours, or how did that work?
Well, it was a bit more laid back than your standard tactical infantry unit that you might be in. We did have to come in usually 9 o'clock, which is about average for a garrison kind of job. You have your PT, your physical training in the morning, and then you come in about 9, and you work a standard 9 to 5, essentially. But we come in and work, but it was very flexible because they didn't want the viewers to be stressed out. in a way you could think of, you think of us as kind of their equipment, right? You know, like we're the equipment. We may be people, but we're also sort of their equipment. And so they wanted to make sure the equipment was in top form and wasn't all stressed out and not able to function properly, right? And so they made life pretty easy for us. We did, of course, have extra duties like any military institution. I was the
I was in one of those kind of units, but not nearly as esoteric as what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, not many.
And every once in a while, somebody would come in there that had just came in from Fort Benning or someplace, and thought we should be soldiers, you know.
Yeah, isn't that frustrating? Yeah, you know. Well, that fortunately never really happened at Fort Meade, thank goodness. But we could do stuff on the side. Hopefully, it was business related, you know, work related. I used to read parapsychology books and stuff like that. Although after a while, actually, I got involved in a education program through the Department of Defense for strategic intelligence. So that was what I do on part time to kind of distract myself. But we would train and we would work sessions according to a set schedule. And we would teach other people as we got new recruits and we teach them. We would get involved sometimes, towards the end of the last 5-6 years of the program, we actually sometimes went places to work. So, for example, we did a job down to Key West several times, actually, down to Key West, work with Joint Task Force 4 and the counter-narcotics stuff. It was an interesting place to work. It really was. And it was relatively stress-free as far as a military job is concerned. It's really kind of unusual from that perspective.
So now you came down and transferred to academia, and also I guess all your clients these days mostly are who? Companies and corporations and advertising people, or is it just anybody?
So you have to think about it in these terms. There are actually more than one one aspect to remote viewing business. One is the training portion of where you teach people how to do it. And then there is what we call operational remote viewing, where you may get hired by somebody or may get asked by somebody to do something in a real-world target, right? Right now, I've kind of got the operational side of it on hold because of a bunch of other stuff that's going on. It's very time-consuming to do operational remote viewing. But when we do it, I have done work for two different corporations, two, maybe three. Can't remember how many now. Done a number of things for police departments, private detective, for other people like that. You know.
Yeah. Now, is it for the police and private detectives? Is that like locating murder bodies and victims?
Yeah. A fairly wide range, but it isn't as much as you would think, or maybe it would be as much as you'd think, because. It's remote viewing isn't widely accepted by police departments, and it isn't widely accepted in the corporate world either. You have to have some forward-thinking folks willing to go out on a limb before they'll engage a remote viewer or a remote viewing company in trying to solve a problem that they may have.
You probably find it difficult to work in an atmosphere where there's a bunch of skeptics around, or maybe not. Maybe you can prove something to them.
I mean, well, it depends. For example, when we were down at Key West working for the intel folks at JTF-4, there were skeptics and open-minded folks on the staff. And one guy, the operations officer, actually was a skeptic. And he challenged me one time because he wanted to see evidence that it really worked, you know, because he was very dubious about it. And I don't know that we ever persuaded him, but I think I set him back a little bit because I don't normally do these kind of things because they aren't really scientific. But he said that there are a lot wrote on this, so I went along with him. He got me off in the room before I was due to go on for an operational session. He said, okay, I just want to see how this works. He said, I have written down a target in my pocket, and I folded it up and several times so there's no way you can see it, and I stuck it in my pocket, and here is the number that designates this target, which is just an arbitrary number. It had no meaning as far as what the target was. I said, well, all right, I'll try it. Can't guarantee it's going to work under the circumstances, but I'll do my best. Cut the paper, pencil and paper. I started going. And basically, the scenario that I sketched out was something along these lines. I had the impression of a green rolling landscape kind of early in the morning with a lot of fog and stuff, or at least it seemed early in the morning because the sun was kind of filtered and not bright yet. And there were a bunch of people in kind of primitive kind of clothes running around with edged weapons beating each other up. And I, you know, it took a little while to describe the scenario, but that's where I came. And he said, okay. And he looked really kind of shocked. He said, I that's enough. He said, I don't know what to think, but you've kind of convinced me. I said, well, okay. He hands me the paper and I unfold it. And the target he'd given me was the Battle of Hastings in 1066. So that was helpful.
Yeah. So, is remote viewing strangeness on a person? Does it wear you out?
It isn't physically tiring, but it's kind of mentally tiring.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. It seems like it might be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a funny kind of tired. You know, you get going into it, and it kind of puts you in a little bit of a mild altered state. You don't start off that way. You don't have to be in an altered state to do remote viewing. But as you go through the process, it kind of takes you there. Which I had not actually realized that, and somebody who's an outside observer mentioned that one time a few years back, and I thought, that's exactly right. That's what happens is when you go through the process, it kind of induces you in a mild altered state. The technical term for that is you get a little dingy, you know? But by the time you're done with that, if you spend an hour and a half in that, you just got to the point where, you know what, I'm done. I don't want to do any more of this, you know, for a while, you know, for a little bit. I want to just go do something else to kind of clear my head, you know. That's sort of the state you get in. Obviously, some people have tried to make it sound like it's dangerous or threatens your health or something, and that's all a bunch of baloney. There's no danger to it. But it does kind of get a little tired. There's actually a kind of funny story told about Mel Riley, who was a fairly widely known remote viewer, the only guy who was actually assigned to the unit twice. He'd been over in the operations building. We had two buildings, one where he did operations, one where he did all the administrative stuff. And he comes out of having done a really long session in the administrative building, and he comes over and there's a dumpster there by the building. I'm sorry, the ops building, dumpster by the building. He comes out and he pulls his keys out of his pocket and he throws them in the dumpster and goes into the admin building. Well, a guy that was with him said, well, Mel, why did you do that? And Mel says, do what? He says, you threw your keys in that dumpster. He said, I did not. He said, yes, you did. And so he had to make Mel go over and look inside the dumpster. And sure enough, there were the keys. So he fished them out of there. And the only thing he could figure was his subconscious telling him that he's in no shape to drive home.
Yeah, interesting story. Good anecdote. Let's tell everyone about how they can get a hold of you and your company. So, do you have a website?
Yes, it is, of course, the standard 3 W's, .rviewer.com. That's the word viewer with the letter R in front of it. So it comes out rviewer.com.
And if they go over to that website, what do they find? What kind of stuff?
Well, that is, it tells you all about my training program. It tells you...
Are you expensive?
I am expensive, I have to say, compared to many of the others out there. But there's a reason for that. My program is very much keyed to individual instruction. So I never have more than 2 students per instructor when I do this. My basic course lasts 5 days. There's 40 hours of classroom instruction. You do a minimum of 12 actual remote viewing sessions. And then when you get done, there's homework for the next, you get 10 more sessions that you work at home, send to me, and I score them. So it's very intense, one-on-one kind of training. I mean, and obviously that's...
Well, we all know small classrooms work, but that's really small.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, anytime I add more than 2 students, I have to pay another instructor and have to bring them on board, so... But this is really for serious people. If you're just curious about remote viewing, there's plenty of other folks out there who aren't nearly as expensive. But I tend to cater to people who are dead serious about it and who really want to go somewhere with it once they're done. So.
And where does one go with it once they adapt it and learn it and master it?
Yeah, it sounds like you're asking why do people do it, right?
Right.
And And that's an interesting question with an interesting answer. Some people come because they want to use it in investing. And you can use it there. There's a mode of remote viewing called associative remote viewing.
We talked to Russell Targ many times about the stock market.
Yeah,
things like
and that's the tool he uses. And many folks have actually done fairly well at it. I mean, it's work. It's not an instant bullet, magic bullet kind of thing. But it is very successful. And in fact, one case, my son was in a college course at University of Colorado. A physics professor taught a kind of a boundaries of physics, boundaries of science kind of class. It was really essentially scientific parapsychology. They learned both sides of the argument. They learned statistics, learned how to do experiments and stuff. And when he found out that my son was in the class, he invited me to come up from Austin and give a lecture on remote viewing during one class period. And then in the evening, I did a workshop where I introduced them to associative remote viewing. And in the course of that, we predicted the correct outcome of a basketball game, 12-2, which is pretty good odds. So anyway, they decided they would do their class project as an ARV, predicting the Fortune 500, not the Fortune 500, the Dow 500, whatever it is, one of the indicators, financial indicators. And one of the auditors in the class was a dot-com millionaire who said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll toss in $10K that you guys can play with. Now, if we win, I get all the money, but if you lose, I'm not going to charge you for what we lost. And so you have some real money to play with. And, okay, all right, we'll do that. Well, they did 7 ARV experiments. Each one of them is correct, which amounted to 7 trades on the stock market. They turned the $10,000 into $26,000. And the dot-com
was very pleased. That's more than double your money.
That's right. And that was just in the last, 2 weeks of school or something, So,
how long did it take them to make that kind of money?
It took them about, it was the last 2 weeks of school. I couldn't tell you how many hours they put into it.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I had a student who actually beat the Texas Pick 3 lottery twice in 2 weeks using ARV. So just to show that you can actually make money with this. And that's one reason people come. Another reason is maybe they want to help the police if they can get in. They might want to do missing children, things like that. But I have to say, and there are other reasons as well, but I have to say the main reason people come to take my class is they're trying to develop evidence, prove to themselves that they really are more than their physical bodies, that they really are more than society claims humans are. You know how our culture kind of says we're all just meat machines and when we die, we're
done.
In
other words, it's a kind of a quest to see if there's afterlife or whatever.
In a way, or you might even say, to some degree, it's self-actualization. Like Maslow talked about his hierarchy of needs, right? And the top thing that people do is trying to find out who they really are and maximize their potential. And this is one way of finding part of our potential that is generally denied by our culture, that it doesn't exist. And these guys come and they take the class and they find that it really does exist, because they produce evidence. In fact, that's one of the really exciting things about being an instructor, teaching people in remote viewing, is to watch that epiphany they have when they're sitting there working and they get done and you give them their feedback and they look at it and they realize, holy cow, I really did get information about this target that I had no way of getting except psychically. I mean, it's just like this whole light goes on. They intellectually believed it for a long time, but there's something about actually doing it yourself that is just, life-changing almost.
Now, have you embraced the paranormal more since you perfected this yourself? Do you deal in other realities? Some remote viewers do, I know.
One thing.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just curious.
No, I'm just trying to think of the best way to answer this. Okay, so to start off with, I was somewhat skeptical, right? And so in that respect, I've certainly embraced it more, because now I know that our minds really are more than our physical bodies. We really can essentially transcend time and space with our consciousness. We're not locked inside our skulls, right? That is very profound.